time for a walk through the garden with Steve Stone. Every week, Steve will give us timely tips for caring for our plants. He'll answer your questions and give us expert advice. Now here's a walk through the garden with Steve Stone. Good morning. We are here with Steve Stone. A walk through the garden with Steve Stone. And it's got a little drizzle going on. We had some rain last night, had some rain earlier in the week. So, well, what's going on?
Last night, I guess, got home from work at 5-ish. I think I had 3/10, which wasn't very much. Mm-hmm. Got up, didn't empty my rain gauge, got up this morning and checked it and had an 1 3/10.
Oh, so we got an inch overnight.
So, according to my rain gauge, we got about an inch.
Yep. As far as I could tell, it didn't start really raining until right around 7:30 last night.
Yeah.
I was down trying to watch them play softball, and they got started on the second game, and that was about it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say we're probably in really good shape as far as the farmers go. The crops have been sufficiently watered, I would say. If you get to, you know, Greenville and go south, you probably are overly wet, because it just seems like those storms that have blown through has just absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
Dayton to Cincinnati has just been blown up, like,
yeah,
every week. They've gotten significant rain. So, yeah, our summer, you know, I guess due to the weather pattern, you know, our summer's been relatively mild as far as temperatures go. I mean, we had some humidity, but relatively mild. And of course, out west is, you know, there's just that weather pattern where they're having some unbelievable heat waves, unusual heat waves,
yeah,
out there.
So. Yeah, in the northwest, it's, you know, they had, you know, temperatures one day, they in the northwest, I can't remember if it's Seattle area or,
yeah,
Oregon or somewhere up in there, they had their high temperature that day was higher than any ever recorded in Las Vegas.
Ooh, well, that's not good.
And then the next week, Las Vegas got higher than that. But, you know, you expect that in Las Vegas. You don't expect that in the Northwest.
I did read there was one day or 2 days in a row that Death Valley was 130.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's brutal.
Yeah, it is.
That is brutal.
Years ago, I'd spoken to a guy who did these 100-mile runs.
The ultra marathons.
Ultra marathons. And he's been out in Death Valley, and he said in Death Valley, when you're running on the roads, you run on the white line.
It'll melt your shoes.
And I couldn't believe it, but I've talked to several people since then and said, yeah, oh yeah, it'll, you know, your foot's on the ground basically a tenth of the time, and it'll still melt your shoes if you run on the blacktop. That's crazy.
I can't remember what year it was. I'm going to say 2009, maybe. I ran a marathon in Death Valley.
Oh.
But I ran it in January.
So it was only 95?
No. It's actually a hilarious story. So I had some friends and said, hey, we're going to do a marathon in Death Valley. And I said, it's wintertime. I can handle that. So we went out there, and Death Valley is a beautiful place. It's incredible. I wouldn't go out there in July, but, yeah, you know, in the wintertime, it's an incredibly, unusually beautiful place. And it was supposed to be one of the prettiest marathons in the United States. You start at, obviously, the lower elevations, and then there's actually some mountains out there, and you get 26 miles, and you kind of run up through the mountains. And it was a trail marathon. So it's supposed to be beautiful. So we get there on Friday, and Friday night, the higher elevations where we were supposed to run was cool enough, it actually snowed. So when we got up in the morning, they're like, well, it's, you know, there's 3 inches of snow. It's, you know, we feel like it's going to be kind of dangerous to run. We're just going to have you run an out back, which is out to Badwater and back, which Badwater is 320 feet below sea level. So that was disappointing, because that run was like running a dirt path. You know, it just wasn't anything to get. And it was an out back, so you see the same thing, you know. So I was really disappointed. Well, Death Valley averages 1 inch of rain per year. So when we started the marathon, it started raining. It rained the whole race.
So that's 3-4 hours?
Yes. Oh. They got 2 inches of rain in about 4 hours, which is like, unbelievably unusual. And we were running to 320 feet below sea level with 2 inches of rain. So on the way back, we were running through gullies and water that was almost up to your knees. And the path kind of washed out, and it was absolute, and it was cold. It was absolutely miserable. When I finished, I threw away my shorts, my socks, my shoes. I was mud from the chest down. It was absolutely miserable. And the guy that we talked to after the race said, well, that's really unusual. We'd never get rain like this. And I'm like, well, I'm glad I was here.
Yeah, so now you can say you froze in Death Valley.
Oh, it was brutal. Absolutely brutal.
So did you see any nice flowers and plants out there?
Well, you know, it's hilarious that you mentioned that, but Death Valley does have a lot of beautiful terrain and flowers and stuff. And when you, they only average an inch of precipitation a year, but when they do occasionally get more than an inch, like of course this time they had 2 inches. Yes. You know, a month after I got home, there was all kinds of articles about this is the prettiest spring Death Valley's ever had because of that 2 inch rain that I was there for. The wildflowers were like a once in a 50 year bloom because of all the rain that they had, and the yellow and the lavenders and the purples and stuff, it just as far as the eye could see was just absolutely incredibly vivid and beautiful. And I'm like, well, I was there to see the preamble to all the beauty. Yeah, but
you were doing the rain dance.
Oh man, it was bad. I must have looked really bad because I was maybe 5 miles from the finish line, and one of the race guys came up and said, "Sir, it's okay if you want me to, you know, take you up to the finish line." And I'm like, oh, no. Heck no. I made it this far. I'm making it. But I must have been pale and white and cold. And, oh, it was quite a story.
And muddy.
Oh, I'm not exaggerating when I say I probably had a full coffee cup full of grit, gravel, and grime in each one of my shoes. The water was so deep, and you just couldn't keep it out. It was miserable. It was absolutely miserable.
I don't think I'd like that stuff in my shoes.
Oh, it was brutal. Well, they never made it back to Ohio.
You had to run with all that garbage in there. I can't stand a tiny little speck in my shoe. It just makes me crazy. I have to stop and take my shoe off.
And I believe that was Saturday, and it was. The race was on Saturday, and we were supposed to stay. The place we stayed was a really cute cabin, and Furnace Creek was the name of the place where we stayed. Mm-hmm. And when I finished the race and took a shower and started feeling like a human again, they were sandbagging around our cabin. And so the parking lot flooded, and we decided at that point to make as fast as we could get back to Vegas. So we drove into Vegas that night and spent the night in Vegas because we were afraid we weren't going to be able to get out of Death Valley because of all the rain that was coming. But it was quite a trip.
So flowers, plants, things, trees.
Well, you know, again, the summer's been pretty mild. I mean, the lawns are doing, you know, pretty well. You still are going to have some brown in your lawn this time of year, especially if you have Kentucky bluegrass or perennial rye, because they're not huge fans of heat and humidity. If you have a turf-type tall fescue lawn, it probably looks like $1 million because it's happy as can be with warmer temperatures, and we've had plenty of rainfall to keep the turf-type fescue growing, actively growing, and thick, and for the most part healthy. I'm starting to see some disease issues. I've looked at a couple different lawns that were starting to show some disease issues. This time of year, you're just simply not going to get around the fact that you're going to see some dollar spot and brown patch. Again, you can treat for it. Fungicides, turf fungicides can be quite expensive. It is possible to treat for it, but it's not been so far, it's not been really bad. I mean, we're only halfway, or are we halfway? About halfway through July, so we've got the rest of July and August to contend with as far as heat and humidity goes. Once we get into September, you don't usually get the enough consistent days of humidity to see disease progress. So in looking at the forecast looks, you know, relatively mild. As far as temperatures go, we don't have any really stupid high temperatures in the forecast. As soon as I say that, it'll probably change. So again, I don't anticipate at this point seeing a lot of issues with diseases, but if you are seeing some brown patches pop up, you definitely want, if they're larger areas, you definitely want to, I guess if you're concerned about it, give me a call. I'll come out and look at it, and we can decide if, you know, what it is, first of all, and then if it's, you know, worth the effort and cost to do treatment for that. A dollar spot starts as a disease, and you'll start to see brown patches about the size of a silver dollar. So that's kind of how it gets its name, dollar spot. And then those spots over time will get bigger and bigger, and they can get as big as a basketball, and then those areas kind of merge with other areas, so then you can start getting larger and larger spots or dead areas. You know, in some cases, you know, lawns will heal from that relatively quickly, relatively easily. And again, if you have a super high maintenance turf, like you can tolerate a little bit of that in most home lawns. If you're, you know, the Mercer County Elks or, you know, Salina Lynx or, you know, Portland Golf Club, you know, that it's a little bit more concerning for them, because they're, you know, trying to keep the fairways and stuff a lot more, you know, pristine and manicured. Bluegrass and perennial rye, again, bluegrass specifically can heal relatively easily, depending on how bad the situation is. It's definitely something from a golf course standpoint, which isn't a problem from a residential standpoint, but it certainly can be a problem with bent grass. Bent grass is beautiful, obviously, for putting on, but it's also an incredibly high-maintenance turf. It's susceptible to every bug disease that's out there. So you really have to keep a grueling schedule with treatment on your greens and tees if you have bent grass, if you're wanting, you know, to make sure those are pretty untouched as far as diseases go. So those are definitely that's definitely a turf that has to be treated on a very rigid basis to keep the diseases from getting bad. But I have seen a little bit of disease issues, certainly not as bad as I've seen it in past, and diseases are 100% related to temperatures. So we're certainly getting...
What about moisture? Does that make much difference?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. The disease triangle has the three corners on it is an environment and a susceptible host and moisture. So if you have a dry summer, your lawn's probably, if you're not watering, going to go off color or turn brown, but you're not going to have a disease issue because you don't have moisture. So diseases are going to be bad with an excessive amount of rainfall and humidity, or again humidity and lots of humid days and days where you have a lot of heavy dew in your turf to start the day consistently every morning. That those all work together to create, you know, the issues that you could see throughout the summer. And like I said, I've seen a little bit of, I looked at one lawn that was a little bit more damaged than I guess I was very surprised what it looked like. And the person thought it was probably a disease issue. After I looked at it a lot more closely, I thoroughly am convinced it was a misapplication, because the consistency of the damage and the way that lawn was damaged and the lawn immediately next door to it wasn't damaged led me to believe that there potentially was a misapplication, and that's what caused the damaged turf. It wasn't necessarily a disease issue. Although there was a disease present in the turf, it just didn't stand to reason when I looked at the proximity of the other properties to that one and didn't see any damage on those lawns, that I was fairly certain that the husband maybe did something that wife wasn't aware of, or wouldn't admit to, because it
or didn't realize he didn't have his spreader set at the right. Yeah,
wasn't calibrated quite right. So you know, again, I felt like it certainly was an issue, but the damage wasn't severe enough that it is going to kill the turf. It just kind of browned everything really bad, and the crowns were still moist and alive, and so it was something that with a little bit of watering, you could grow the problem out of the lawn. So yeah, it's kind of being a detective when you're looking at stuff like that. You kind of have to look at a lot of different factors and connect some dots to figure out, you know, what happened, which, you know, is actually in a lot of cases kind of fun. We take pictures and of lawn in this day and age with cell phones, you can take pictures, really good, crisp, clean pictures. And I've got a really close friend that's got his master's in turf grass management from Ohio State. He's a cool dude. And we exchange pictures back and forth. Hey, Stoney, what do you think this is? And I'll look at it. And then we've got a few of the professors at Ohio State that we still keep in touch with. So we can all kind of share pictures back and forth with each other. And
there's still professors there from when you were there 50 years ago?
Well,
has it not been quite that long?
It actually wasn't quite 50 years ago, but it is. Man, it's funny you say that. There are still a few guys that are around, and there are some guys that are still in the industry that I've known for years and years and years and years. And it's especially in Ohio, it's I mean, it's in what we do. I mean, it's honestly, it's kind of a small family kind of a thing. I mean, the kid that I call him a kid. He's quite a bit younger than me. He graduated, I think, back in the probably early 2000s or maybe mid 2000s from Ohio State. And so we had some professors that overlapped, and then, so yeah, we know a lot of the same people. A lot of the guys certainly have retired, and they're just not really in the business anymore. But some of the guys retire from Ohio State, and then they might still work in the industry. Mm-hmm. Dave Shetler was the great guy. Dr. Dave Shetler's the bug doc for Ohio State. He's an entomologist, and he's been an entomologist at Ohio State forever. Dave Shetler's a really cool guy. Enjoy talking to him. And there's Dave Gardner is a turf specialist at Ohio State. He's been there for a long time. But it's funny you say that. I did have an agronomy teacher at Ohio State that had had three generations of students. He had the grandpa, he had the dad, and he had the son teaching agronomy at Ohio State.
That's pretty good.
So, yeah, he was an old dude when I was there. So,
yeah.
He was a good guy.
He's probably not still there.
I'm going to guess he's not there anymore. I don't think he's made it to that fourth generation, but he did make it to grandfather, dad, and son teaching agronomy at Ohio State. So that was, they can stick around for a while.
Yeah. Well, if they get to a good place and they're good at it, why not stay?
That's right. Well, we better take a break.
Yeah, we probably should.
All right.
We'll be back in just a minute.
The versatile Kubota B-Series is a do-it-all tractor. Run powerful attachments that can be easily switched out. It features a hydrostatic transmission and is simple to maintain. The Kubota B-Series. It makes the hard work look easy. Talk to your local Kubota dealer today to schedule a demo.
Your local Kubota dealer is Hall Brothers in Fort Recovery, Ohio.
Buying a new grill from a big warehouse is like trying to start your old grill. You can end up standing around by yourself and nothing happens. That's not what happens at Ace. Wengler Ace Hardware has an exclusive lineup of premium brands plus premium service from the people who know you best. We'll make sure you get the right grill, whether it's gas, wood pellet, or a flat top griddle. And better yet, we'll assemble and deliver it right to your patio. Don't forget, your newest grill is never far away, and neither is our help. That's why grilling starts at Ace. Stop by Wengler Ace Hardware in Fort Recovery, your grilling destination.
Looking to become a part of a company that uses the vision of their team members to assist them in becoming successful? Cooper Farms does just that. We utilize the ideas and visions of our team members to make our processes better, easier, safer today. The Fort Recovery Division of Cooper Farms is currently seeking individuals to fill open egg packaging and sanitation positions. To learn more about these positions, as well as other open positions, please visit cooperfarms.com/join our team. Cooper Farms, more than a workplace.
Hi, this is Connor Rammel, member of the Fort Recovery Friends of the Arts. Stop down to Hein Amphitheater in Van Trees Park to see us Sunday, July 18th at 7 p.m. for the Bulldogs. The Bulldogs have been bringing the oldies back for nearly 20 years and will take you back to the days of the drive-in and sock hop. They have performed with artists like Chubby Checker, Herman's Hermits, and the Beach Boys. For more information, please pick up a brochure. Visit our website at FortRecoveryFriendsOfTheArts.com or find us on Facebook.
The National Night Out, sponsored by the Fort Recovery Police Department, will be held on Sunday evening, July 18th at Ambassador Pool and Community Park from 5 to 8 p.m. This will be a free event for all Fort Recovery area families, and children under 12 will need to be accompanied by an adult. There will be free food and drinks and free swimming. Our police cruisers will be there, along with the Southwest Mercer Fire Truck and the Squad 3 Ambulance. Come on up to Ambassador Pool and be part of the National Night Out. Sunday, July 18th from 5 to 8, sponsored by the Fort Recovery Police Department.
And we're back on Walk Through the Garden with Steve Stone.
We've been walking through a lot of different places.
Yeah,
today.
We walked through Death Valley. We waded through 2 feet of water in Death Valley,
yeah,
a lot of places.
And, unbelievable.
Desert.
We want to say, give a shout out to Kathy Gonzalez and Tony.
Oh, yeah.
Gonzalez. I think they're kind of in charge of the 5K today.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And
they have been for a while. I know that.
They certainly do an unbelievable job. There's no two people any more dedicated to running and biking and exercise than them two. I wish I had their dedication.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the weather looks a little dreary for the 5K today, but I know they really put a lot of work and effort into it. So.
Well, when it's a kind of a warm day, when I came in about 45 minutes ago, there's a little bit of drizzle, and that's probably not too bad for those guys.
No, 5Ks, you know, 5Ks or events like that are not bad. With certainly overcast is
yeah,
ideal.
Yeah,
at least for me, you don't overheat nearly as fast, and a little bit of rain is usually pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, a little drizzle isn't bad. You really don't want to do it in a downpour, but
no,
it's certainly not bad. So I hope they get the 5K in and they have a good turnout.
Yep, and I most kind of events that people are participating in, any kind of drizzle will kind of hold the crowd down, and it might for this, but a lot of the runners like being in the, you know, they're getting that mist.
That's right.
You know, that they, you know, because when it's those hot days, there are people that along the running route that'll have their garden hoses out and let them run through it.
Yeah.
So probably won't need very many of those today.
No, but, I don't think so.
But what's going on with more turf flowers?
The stuff? Other thing that is, we're just, you know, it's the time of year to see it, to again shift gears and talk a little bit about bugs and some of the things that's going on. Certainly. The bagworms are still super active and creating a lot of damage. Now, at this point, earlier in the season, in this early summer, late spring, when I was talking about bagworms, you might have had to have really good eyesight to see them little critters.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even a magnifying glass at some point. Now, this time of year, they're so big, you nearly have to be blind not to see them. Because they're, and I say dramatically bigger, they're probably pushing, you know, a half an inch long, and they're carrying their little bag around with them. They start making that as soon as they kind of start moving and eating. They start creating a little bag, for lack of a better term. It actually looks like a little short, tiny ice cream cone, like an ice cream sugar cone. And that's their house, and they kind of drag their house around with them as they eat. And then as they eat, they keep building with silk that they can make. They keep making that bag. Then by the end of the season, it's probably an inch and a half long, and then that's where they make their cocoon and spend the winter. So again, they should be pretty obvious right now as far as the insect itself. The amount of damage that they can create because of the size they are at this point, they can really strip evergreens, specifically like arborvitaes and spruces and pines. They can strip an area relatively quickly because usually there's just not one. There's usually a group of them or multiple insects. So again, if you just are out casually kind of mowing or weeding or whatever, and you see a plant that looks thin, oddly thin, or you start seeing some really odd brown patches kind of throughout the plant, you need to look at it a lot more closely. And if you're seeing those insects, you got to treat those sooner than later, because again, they can cause a tremendous amount of damage. And in some cases, you know, you can spray and the plants will heal relatively quickly. And in some cases, if you're slow to the trigger on treatment, they can strip, again, evergreens and spruces and arborvitaes to the point where they don't recover effectively, or they become so misshapen that you end up, you know, considering taking them out. Now, if you do find them on a deciduous plant, which I have seen them on Japanese maples, and I have seen them on just this spring or early summer here, I saw them on a flowering crabapple. Now, those plants, deciduous plants, can tolerate the defoliation because they're used to obviously losing their leaves every fall. So it's incredibly unlikely and nearly impossible that that insect is going to kill a deciduous tree. It's going to strip the foliage off of it, but it's not going to kill the tree. It just eats the foliage. It doesn't damage the stem, buds, or branches or anything like that. So the plant's going to recover perfectly fine. But you really need to treat it anyhow, because that obviously that insect is going to continue to eat and live its life and reproduce. And so then you're going to have a higher population, and then that new generation in the spring that comes out and emerges is certainly going to be able to affect, you know, other plants in your yard and your neighbor's property and stuff. And so it eventually is going to get into something like an evergreen that can cause damage. So although it's not going to kill a deciduous plant, you still want to treat it if you see it on that, because you got to manage the population. If the population gets too high, you know, again, it's going to eventually get into something that it potentially is going to kill. So not as important timely wise to treat your deciduous plants if you're seeing them, but certainly needs treated nonetheless. Also, this is the time of year that we are seeing the European mass chafers, which are a beetle looking insect that is kind of a medium tan to a real light brown, tan to brown color, like a hard shelled insect. It's about maybe a little smaller than a dime as far as its overall shape, but they're again relatively big, kind of again a hard shelled, got a hard shelled back. It has wings, but it has the wing covers that are hard, a hard shell. And again, they're brown. They are very active at this point, and they will feed on a lot of different things. They will nibble on foliage of trees like lindens. They will nibble on flowers, roses. They'll eat the petals of the plant and the leaves themselves. If you've got lots of annuals like Nikki and I do, they'll get into the annuals and they'll just devour anything they can kind of get their mandibles on, whether it's leaves, flowers, whatever. And again, the population knock on wood, so far this year, I'm seeing them. I'm seeing quite a few of them around my house, but I'm not seeing the devastating population like I have in the past. So the first ones to emerge are going to be the European mass chafers. The second ones that are going to emerge that look similar, I mean, as far as they're a beetle, they're the same size as the mass chafer, but they're dramatically different color. They have a very metallic green, hard shell on the back, and then their head is kind of a real light tan color. Those are Japanese beetles. Those two beetles are out and active, and they are eating and feeding and living their best life, because they're eating and mating, and that's kind of all they're up to at this point. So they're trying to, the guys are out trying to find a female and eating, and they'll again get into their host plants are so wide ranging that it's you can't even begin to name all of them. Again, they'll eat roses, they'll eat the petals of the flowers, and they'll eat the foliage. They can get into all of our containers we have at home. We have all kinds of different varieties of petunias. They eat the petunias, the flowers. We have a hardy hibiscus, and we also have the tropical hibiscus. They seem to really like the flowers of the tropical hibiscus, so they'll get down into those flowers and they'll just start eating the petals off the flowers. But they'll nibble on anything. They'll get into trees. They seem to really like greenspire lindens for some reason. One of their favorite foods is a greenspire linden, and they will skeletonize the leaf, so they'll eat all the interveinal tissue and they leave you a leaf that looks like a doily that you'd lay on your coffee table. But again, with a high enough population, they can cause a lot of damage. They seem to really like purple, maroon, red leaves, too. You'll see them on plum bushes and Japanese maples, and then the cherries, like the Newport cherry that has the real dark, Mount St. Helens cherry that have the real dark purple foliage. They seem to really be attracted to anything that has purple foliage as well. Again, you'll see a lot of them. You'll see the defoliation. You'll see the skeletonization of the leaves. And they're easy to see because they're big. And if you get up and kind of get close to them and disturb them, they'll fly away. And a lot of times they'll fly towards you and they'll land on you, which they don't bite, but they look menacing,
and they're creepy.
They look creepy, and they have this I don't know how to describe it. They're kind of creepy looking, and when they land on you, it's not like a mosquito. They're big enough when they land on you, you feel them land on you. So again, people will jump and scatter when they're out. Again, they don't bite you, they don't harm you, but they will cause a tremendous amount of damage to your flowers and your trees, which again, besides an aesthetic issue with your flowers, they won't kill your flowers, but they can ravage them to the point where they look really raggedy. What those insects are, those is they're the mast chafer and the Japanese beetles. They're mating and eating and doing their thing. They're the ones. Oh, this is a good tie-in to what you were talking about earlier. It just came to me. Did you see a light bulb above my head?
Yes, I thought it was the clock, but okay. Apparently it was a light bulb.
Yep. The Japanese beetles and the mast chafers are mating, and they're going to lay eggs, and they lay eggs in the turf. And if you have a dry summer, they lay a dehydrated egg, and so the egg has to imbibe or absorb moisture before it will become viable and hatch into a grub. Mm-hmm. If you have a dry summer, you have limited emergence because they don't get enough moisture. Which is kind of another side topic that's funny when you have people that have irrigation and they complain, well, I take care of my yard and I water it all the time and I've got grubs tearing my yard up, and that guy next door, he doesn't do anything to his yard ever and he doesn't have grubs. And I'm like, well, the grubs aren't stupid. They can fly over a lawn and say, that's brown, that's green. I'm laying my eggs there because it's green and it's getting moisture. It's getting watered regularly. So that's why you have grubs, because you take care of your lawn. And so anyhow, they lay a dehydrated egg. If they get moisture, they're going to pop out and emerge and cause damage. So, point to this rambling horse manure is, if we have a wet summer, which we have so far, I mean, I don't want to say wet, but we've had rain events consistently enough that there's enough moisture in the ground that as these things are mating and laying eggs, there's probably going to be enough moisture in the ground that they're going to emerge, they're going to hatch, and they are the grubs are the ones that create a tremendous amount of damage in your lawn in September, starting early to mid-September into October. You're going to have the potential, if you've got grubs, those little suckers mow the roots off of your turf, and then you've got these humongous dead areas. So that's the reason to treat them as an adult, because again, they're very susceptible to a lot of different types of insecticides, and it's relatively easy to kill the suckers. So if you kill the adults, they're not going to lay eggs. And you potentially are going to head off a catastrophe in that if you kill the adults, they're not going to lay eggs. So you're not going to have any potential for, grub damage. Now, again, when you treat yours and kill all of your bugs on your property, doesn't necessarily mean the neighbor's going to do the same. So it's not foolproof, but it does help.
Yep.
So
let's take a quick break. We'll come back and summarize and get you off to work so your boss doesn't get mad at you.
Looking forward to that.
Back in just a minute.
Hi, this is Steve Stone from Nature's Green, and if you need any or all the quality products to get started on your lawn and landscape this spring, we have it at Nature's Green. Soils, mulch, flowers, vegetable plants, seeds, trees, shrubs, perennials, insecticides, fungicides, you name it, we have it. But most of all, we have the knowledge and expertise that will help you get through any project. Stop out and see us at Nature's Green and load up on everything you need, or we can deliver it. Just call us at 419-375-2322. Nature's Green, your landscape's best friend.
Proudly serving the Fort Recovery area for over 23 years, Fort Camp Excavating and Farm Drainage has the expertise to handle any dirt work you need. From installing waterways and building pads to demolition work and septic system installation, Fort Camp Excavating and Farm Drainage has all the equipment you need to get the job done right. Does your driveway need some fresh gravel, or do you need some dirt hauled in? We can take care of all your hauling needs as well. Give Brian a call at 419-852-6655. Fort Camp Excavating and Farm Drainage. Go Indians.
If you like to grill out, Wayne Street Market is your go-to place for everything you need. Stock up now during their No Limit Meat Sale with great prices on their well-trimmed steaks. Ribeyes are $9.99 a pound. New York strips, T-bones, and flat iron steaks are just $8.99 a pound. And ground chuck is $3.59 a pound, loose or patties. And don't forget the brats. Choose from Carando, Johnsonville, and Swaggerty. And if you like to cook breakfast on your Blackstone griddle, be sure to pick up some eggs, potatoes, onions, and peppers. And their IPC bacon is just $4.49 a pound in their grab-and-go meat section. Get everything you need during their No Limit Meat Sale at Wayne Street Market, the best meat market around. This is a reminder for the Red Cross Blood Drive at the Legion on Monday, July 26th. All reservations are full, so please be on time for your appointment. If you don't have an appointment, you can show up for walk-ins, but you might get turned away unless someone cancels their appointment. Again, a reminder to those with appointments for the blood drive at the Legion on Monday, July 26th. Please be on time for your appointment, since all available slots are filled.
The Fort Recovery Friends of the Arts invites you to join us again this summer for another great lineup. We are bringing back many popular favorites from last summer and adding some exciting new acts as well. From a Journey tribute band to Neil Diamond and Toby Keith impersonators to classic country, oldies, and pop, we're sure there's something that will appeal to everyone in the family. Join us on Sunday evenings throughout the summer at Hein Amphitheater in Vantrees Park at 7 p.m. For more information, pick up a brochure, find us on Facebook, or visit our website at FortRecoveryFriendsOfTheArts.com.
We're back. Walk through the garden with Steve Stone. And so we were talking about some diseases and some insects and stuff, but we didn't have a show last week because you were at the Good Guys Car Show in Columbus, which is a huge event of really... Is it all muscle cars?
No, the Good Guys is a car club, I guess you could call it, but it's nationwide, mm-hmm. and they have events in Nashville, and Columbus is one of their biggest, but they'll have... regional car shows, northeast, northwest, south, Arizona, California, Washington. The closest one to us is they have one in Nashville, which is in the spring. I can never seem to get away for that one. And then they have the Columbus is one of their biggest shows, and they have it at the state fairgrounds. And they put on a great event, a great show. I think there was around somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 cars there.
Thousand.
That's a lot. That's
a lot.
And you will see everything: hot rods, muscle cars. 100% stock. Cars that would have been the same as they came out from the factory. You'll see crazy. Crazy horsepower, souped up. You'll find just about anything there, and it's an event that I'd like go to pretty consistently every year. Last year, of course, they didn't have it because of COVID, but the year before we were there, and just a really, really interesting, lots of things to look at. Paint, interior, you know, motors. I mean, it's just vendors. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of vendors there. Just really interesting. Cool weekend. Lots of good food. Had a bunch of people from Fort Recovery that went. And it's just a really kind of a fun party scene. And again, all the gearheads and the guys that are into cars and wheels and tires and motors and horsepower and stuff like that. It's quite an event. And the good guys do a really good job. They have it set up very, very nicely, kind of easy in, easy out. And we had a couple motel rooms, so we stayed up there. And it was a neat event.
Yeah, I remember Mike Tin several times talking about going there and how much fun it is and how you see everything.
Yep. Yeah, there's something. If you're into any kind of cars, there's pretty much, unless it's like European stuff, it's definitely Detroit kind of a American car auto show. Mm-hmm. And again, all different years, from street rods that are 32 Fords, 23 T buckets, anything, all the way up to some of the new that they have a cutoff date as far as the year goes. You can't get in there like with a new Corvette or a new Mustang or something like that. But all the way up into the late 70s, early 80s, you'll see anything and everything, and usually you'll see some really unusual stuff. So it's a neat event.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be pretty cool. So yep. Do they give out awards, anything like that? Or is it more of a just everybody puts their car out there and everybody can go around and go, ooh, I like that one?
There is, they do judging, and they have an event area or a judging area where you can take your car and you can compete for, I think they gave out on Saturday, the top 20 of, they called it Builder's Choice, and they have gearheads, builders, all kinds of experts that are in that area, and then mm-hmm. you can enter your car, and then they'll come and they'll judge you. And again, I think they gave out top 20 in Builder's Choice, but it is, there's a different hierarchy or whatever. I took my car there, or a couple of my cars there, and I enjoy going and I enjoy showing my cars off because I think they're pretty awesome. But the guys that are, it's gotten to the point where the guys that are in that Builder's Choice literally are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on their cars. And so I enjoy looking at them, and they're phenomenal. But I drive mine to Columbus, and so those guys, I call those trailer queens.
Yeah.
They get trailered in and out. It's like having a couch. It's just kind of something you look at or set in.
Yeah.
You don't drive it. So, but they're incredible. And if you are into cars like that and you see all those guys that have the different like bitchin' rides and all those guys that have their TV shows, because there's so many of them now.
Yeah.
All those guys are there. I can't remember his name. Otis Wendell knows the guy that is the head honcho guy for Bitchin' Rides was there, and him and Otis somehow developed a friendship. And so when they see each other, of course you can't miss Otis.
Yeah,
they talk all the time. So he's a huge celebrity in that car circle. But somehow him and Otis developed a really cool friendship, and they talk to each other whenever they see each other at shows. But those big dogs are there, and they usually have a car that they've just finished, and they'll introduce a new car that they just did. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people, if you watch in that car circles, that'll have TV shows and the YouTube videos and stuff. All those big dogs are there, and they're showing stuff off. So us little guys kind of go to ooh and ah over what they're working on, and maybe, like I said, rub elbows with them a little bit. But it's all good. It's a lot of fun.
Yep. So, we kind of concluded with not much dealing with lawns
we'll be
and
back.
Flowers. But
we'll be back next Saturday, and you never know. It's kind of Russian roulette. You just never know what you're going to get when you tune in on Saturday mornings with me and Neil.
Yeah, and somewhere along the line, it's going to start being talking about Buckeyes football.
Oh.
At least I'll probably say something, and then it'll be off 20 minutes.
I just found out yesterday, my son Cade and I, one of our favorite Ohio State players of all time, newer, younger players, I guess, announced his retirement yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that. Teddy Ginn.
Teddy Ginn Jr.
And so when I saw that, I thought,
14 years. Yeah. Cade and I talked about that last night. It's like, is it possible that he's been in the NFL for 14 years?
No.
He's been away from Ohio State for 14 years.
I was sitting out at the bowling alley at their pizza buffet, and I asked somebody, I said, because I saw it and then it went off the screen. I said, that just said Teddy Ginn Jr. is retiring. How long ago did he? And it said when he graduated, yep. When he started in the NFL. I said, so how long ago did he graduate from Ohio State? And the guy said, I'm going to say 6 or 7 years. And it was 14. And I said, he started in the NFL in 2007. I said,
Cade and I talked about that.
We couldn't believe it.
Cade and I talked about that last night. He said, 14 years. And I'm like, That it can't be right. 14 years. Boy, if you have never seen him play at Ohio State, especially, I don't follow the pros, but that dude had a second and third gear it made everybody on the field look like they were standing still. I watched him play a lot of football games, and he just had a gear that wasn't possible to catch him. It just really wasn't. His speed was... It was insane. He was so electric to watch. He was so much fun.
And it, like we said, just seems like not very long ago he was playing at Ohio State.
I know.
And it's been 14 years.
He was
crazy.
I guess
14 years in NFL is a really long career.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is. He's done very well. I hope he's done very well. I mean, he's made it a long time in the...
Yeah.
Do I have time to tell a quick story?
I have to leave at noon.
Okay. So at some point, years back, Jim Tressel came to Salina, to Romers, to do a talk and fundraiser thing. And I had an opportunity to go listen to him. I also had an opportunity to do a meet and greet with him before, so I got a chance to talk to him and got my picture taken with him, talked to him for a long time. And he was talking. He's a very good guy, very easy to talk to. And it was, I think, it was either Ted Ginn's Jr.'s freshman year or sophomore year, and Tressel made the comment that, Ted, he's going to be quite a special player. He said, he's something else. He said, I don't know if you know this or not, but he's really fast. And everybody's like, yeah, he's really fast. And he said, just so you know, when he came to Ohio State, he had two left feet. But by gosh, he worked with me for a little while. Now look at him. And thought, yeah, whatever, dude. But that's just how Tressel was. He's a really easy guy to talk to. But he claims that Ted Ginn had two left feet when he came to Ohio State, and all of his expertise came from helping Tressel helping him. So,
well, we better get you to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't want to get you fired. Your boss is going to be mad. Tune in again next week. If you have questions for Steve, you can email us here at FortRecoveryRadio@outlook.com, or you can email him at Steve@naturesgreennursery.com. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us again this week for a walk through the garden with Steve Stone. If you have a gardening question you'd like Steve to answer, just email him at steve@naturesgreennursery.com and he'll answer it on a later show. Be sure to join us again next week for a walk through the garden with Steve Stone.